Well, the fact that you can represent a state rho for a spin half system by a vector with four probabilities. Sort of motivates the idea that perhaps you only need four ontic states, four distinct ontic states. To get quantum theory, for quantum theory for a qubit, spin half particle. And then I gave you an argument, this ontological excess baggage theorem, as to why this wouldn't work. So that's sort of a shame, it doesn't work. But what we can do is, let's just proceed anyway. Let's try and build a model with four ontic states and see how close it is to quantum theory, see if it looks anything like quantum theory. So let's build a toy theory. Toy model. A toy bit. Toy bit is the analog of a qubit. And this is following on. Well, the best version of this out there is the toy model due to Rob Speckens. There's a paper on the archive in 2004. It may have been published the following year. And I have a version also with a four ontic states in 99. But I think this model of Rob Speckens is much better worked out, and it really addresses this issue. I mean, the whole issue is to do with whether you can have something like a psi epistemic interpretation of quantum theory. So this won't actually be a model for quantum theory. Yes.
So I'm quite confused when you say you have four ontic states per toy bit.
Yeah.
So I mean, I thought you just have four ontic states in total, and a toy bit is basically equivalent to a probability distribution.
So if you have, imagine you have like one, if you have one, one toy bit, which is like having one qubit,
yeah,
then you'd have only four ontic states. But maybe you have two. Two toy bits, so
yeah,
it's like having two qubits. Then you'd have 16 underlying states because you'd have four for each one, so you multiply them together, you get 16, and so on.
Right.
So powers of four. So that's the idea. Yeah. So I'll set it up initially for a toy bit and then take it further. What we end up is having states in this model which are analogous to a subset of the states of a qubit or a spin half particle. I'm using the two terms interchangeably. Actually, analogous to six specific states. Seven, actually, seven if you include the totally mixed state. So, here's the idea. We have four ontic states. I can represent the four possible states by boxes. And you can imagine that you have a particle that's in one of these boxes or something that's in one of these four boxes. So if it's here, that's one ontic state. That's number one. If it's here, it's number two. If it's here, it's number three. If it's here, it's number four. We could imagine that it's in particle one, or it's in box one or two, with equal probability, so probability half. So it's in one of these two boxes. And that's going to be analogous to the spin Z down state. Okay, go back to this. You thought you'd never see this again. It just occurred to me this morning I could use. So here we are, here are the four boxes. The spin Z down state is where you have an equal distribution of it being in the first two boxes. Still this, do this. I was lucky last time I got this to work. Okay, good. So it's in one of these two boxes, you don't know which, equal probability for each, if you accept my shaking technique. And it's not in the other two boxes. So that's the state which is analogous to the spin down state along the Z direction. And then we have another six states. This one is three or four. This is analogous to Z plus. And we have one or three. That's analogous to X plus. The state two or four is analogous to X minus. And then we have two or three is analogous to Y plus. And one or four is analogous to y minus. Okay, so you can imagine I could have prepared any of these states with those four cups and the orange. Oh, and then finally, you have a state which is just an equal distribution of all this. And this is analogous to the identity state. So you have a quarter probability for being in each one. Okay. So basically, on the Bloch sphere, which I can't really draw, we have the six states corresponding to each two on each axis, and then plus one in the very center of the Bloch sphere corresponding to the totally mixed state. So now, how about a measurement well, a measurement is described by taking a set of these kinds of diagrams that cover all squares. So here's an example. A measurement of, think of this as being analogous to a measurement of the X case. And this would be where you perform a measurement and you either look to see if it's in box one and three or two and four. Sorry, yeah, two and four. So that's how you'd model an X measurement. And then the important thing is that after you've done this measurement, you randomize the particle with respect to the two boxes it could have been for that particular outcome. Okay, so can I do this over here? So if I want to do the X measurement, so I need to pick up boxes 1 and 3, put the two together, shake, put them back down. If I hear it, that means that was the outcome. If I don't, it wasn't. And then do the same for 2 and 4, shake, and put it back down. So hearing it is the outcome of the measurement, and then the shaking it is the re-randomization. So let's try this, okay? Okay. So the outcome was the second one, 2, 4, which corresponds to X spin down. Okay. And then just to complete the process, although it wasn't necessary, shake, not that outcome. So that's the idea of the model. So importantly, although it was originally prepared as being in one of these two states, when I make a measurement, I didn't know which one. If I make a measurement of X, it can now, it's possible for it to go over to here if I get that outcome. And so now I don't know if it's in box 2 or 4. So it's sort of, which is consistent with the state now being the eigenstate of the outcome. Okay, but I don't know which one it's in. Actually, I do, because I had to, but you don't. Okay. So if you have more than 2 qubits, then you need to find what the appropriate rules are, you know, what you can measure, what you can randomize, what states you can prepare. And you also be nice to justify these. So Rob Speckens proposed to set up this model. He called it the knowledge balance principle. Okay. So if you have maximal knowledge, so you have the most knowledge you can have about this system, which in the example I told you here corresponds to it being under one of the two cups, but you don't know which one. That's the best knowledge you can have. So if you think about this system, well, the amount of knowledge I have is basically I have one bit of knowledge. I know whether it's, I just made a measurement. So I know it's in one of these two cups. So that's versus not being in these two cups. So I know I have maximal knowledge, and I know it's in one of these two cups, not one of these two cups. So that's sort of one bit of knowledge, if you like. But then I also lack knowledge. I don't know if it's in this cup or this cup. This principle should apply at all times. To both the whole system that you're considering, you may have, you know, 5 toy bits, and also to each subsystem. So what you can do is try to find states, measurements, and also transformations that are consistent with this knowledge balance principle. I'm not going to take you through all of that. Yes?
Is it each system on the board above or all possible subsystems?
Say that again.
By each subsystem, do you mean all possible subsystems or each of just the pair, the subsystems of 2 elements?
So if you have, for example, 3 toy bits, then this principle would have to be true for the total system consisting of the 3 toy bits. And then if you take a partition into 2 and 1 system, it'd have to be true for a pair of toy bits, and for each pair of toy bits, and then it'd also have to be true for each individual toy bit. That's the idea. And it has to be true at each time. So this imposes quite a lot of constraints on what states you can prepare and what dynamics you can have. So let me just, rather than going through what this implies in any sort of generality, let me just talk about a few things you can do. So one thing you can do is make the measurements that I talked about. So you can make these kinds of partitioning measurements. Another thing you can do is a transformation, is you can commute. You can, so for example, you could have 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 4, and 4 to 1. And if you look at this, what does it do? Well, it sends Z minus. Goes to PY plus, and Z plus goes to PY minus, and so on. You can look at the effect it has on all the different states. It leaves the identity state just as it is. So now what happens if you have 2 of these toy bits? Well, you could just have the 2 of them separately prepared in, for example, Z down eigenstates, or analogs of Z down eigenstates. And that would correspond, so now we need 16 squares. Okay. That would correspond to, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, these are the ontic states for each of the 2 qubits. So that would correspond to being here. This is a product state. And so that's one example. Here's another example. you could have something which is analogous to the Bell states. So I'll just draw the diagram. So here's one example. So this is consistent with the rules as they're set up. And so here you can see in this particular state, both the ontic states are the same, but we don't know which they are. So it'd be like if I had another set of four cups corresponding to the second particle. Well, in this state, the orange, you could have an orange and an apple. The orange and the apple will both be in the same numbered cup. We just wouldn't know which cup that was. And this is, we can write this state down. Well, it's an entangled state in the sense that you cannot regard this as a product state. This state is not equivalent to any sort of probabilistic mixture of these states. Of course, it doesn't violate any Bell inequalities because you just have two local systems behaving locally. But it is entangled. It is something that can't be written as a product state. So a Bell basis would now consist of having four states like this. Actually, you know what? I'm just going to write them down symbolically. So we'd have 1, 1, or 2, 2, or 3, 3, or 4, 4. That's the state I just drew. Or 1, 2, or 2, 3, or 3, 4, or 4, 1. So that's where the orange, the apple is in sort of next up cup from the orange, and you wrap around at the end. Okay, we have two more of these. So these four states cover the 16 boxes in here. And so you can think of them as constituting a measurement, the Bell measurement. I mean, they're analogous to a Bell basis measurement. So here we're just setting up a toy model. It's not really quantum theory. But it has a lot of similar properties to quantum theory. Some of the properties it doesn't have are it's not non-local, so it's local. and it's set up to be local. It's sort of, this is one of the constraints of the model. So if you just think about it, if I measure, the only measurements I can make are partitionings on each of the two. If I have two systems separate, I can just partition in different ways to make a measurement. And all that's going to do is reveal the local property, you know, where the apple is or where the orange is. It's not going to violate. It's entirely local mechanism, so it's not going to violate any Bell inequalities. So there's a sense in which you can have something like entanglement in a model, where you think of entanglement as being the inability to represent your state as a product state. Without having a violation of Bell inequalities. In some sense, these things are conceptually different. So Rob has a long list of qualitative features of quantum theory that you can reproduce in this model. So here are some examples. No cloning. There's a no cloning theorem. You have something like interference. Something analogous to the Maxent interferometer, or some aspects of the Maxent interferometer. In particular, you see something that looks like constructive and destructive interference. Quantum or dense coding. You probably haven't covered dense coding in any courses yet. It's a sort of quantum information protocol. It's in some sense dual to teleportation. And okay, so very, very long list of the sort of basic qualitative features of quantum theory that you can reproduce. And I'll just tell you about one of them, the teleportation example. That's an example I gave in my, that was the point of my paper from 1999, was to give a sort of classical account of teleportation. So it's the one I'm most familiar with. So here's how this works. So in teleportation, you have an entangled state you have a qubit coming in. On these two things, you do a Bell measurement. You get an output. And the output is one of four results. Then you send the output over here. And according to what output you get here, you do a unitary transformation on this qubit. And then it works out that whatever qubit you send in here, you get the same qubit, comes out, the system in the same state. So in the toy model version of this, what you do, this is you send in, well, one of the states that you have. And then you have on system A. Then on system B and C, you have a specific Bell state. Then you make a measurement on system A and B in the Bell basis, and you get some information, 1, 2, 3, or 4. And then at the end, you perform a transformation on C, one of these permutation transformations I mentioned, and the system comes out in the same state it went in. So just let's give an example. So imagine the state that you send in is the z minus state. Okay. So now you perform a measurement on the Bell basis, and what you're doing is you're discovering, so basically in this case, the particle is actually in one of these boxes, so it may actually be in one. And then these two particles are actually in correlated boxes. They are actually either in box one and then one, or two and then two, or three and then three, then four, then four. When you do this Bell measurement, you're discovering what the difference is between the two boxes, whether particle A is in the same box as particle B, or whether it's in a box which is displaced by a certain amount. So if you get this outcome for your Bell basis measurement on AMB, then you know that both particles are in the same box. Okay. If you get this outcome, then you know that particle B is in a box that's one greater than particle A with the wraparound and so on. Okay. It would have been better to have called box the first box, box zero, because then you could use modular arithmetic. I'm going with Rob's notation. So does that make sense? So what you reveal here is the difference between the two boxes. And so now that's the outcome of this measurement. So all you have to do here now is a permutation which corrects for that difference. So if you get the first outcome, the first Bell basis measurement, then this system over here will already be in the same state as the ingoing system. But if you get one of the others, then you have to correct. And so in this way, you reproduce the same qualitative features of teleportation. I'm not sure I did a great job of explaining that. Are there any questions? Okay. Yes?
What happens when you try to apply all those ideas to, say, quantum cryptography?
When you apply this to quantum cryptography?
Yeah. Presumably you can produce analogous protocols such as PV84 and things like that.
So you wouldn't be able to do device-independent quantum cryptography, which relies on an actual violation of Bell's inequalities. However, okay. If you can be sure that there's no way, you know, that Eve can't violate the rules of this theory, then even just measuring on here, you'd have a random bit, secretly shared random bit. And I think there's some work, if you search on secret bits, there's some work in the literature on secret classical bits and showing that they're a useful resource for cryptography, which is analogous to quantum theory in some way. Yeah, so I think it would apply there.
In the teleportation example, in quantum mechanics, you're technically teleporting information.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, so so you can see my 1999 paper for discussion of this.
In quantum teleportation, you're kind of translating information, whereas here you're doing finite information.
So if your incoming state is, in the quantum case, then these things can vary over, you know, the real numbers. So it seems like there's an infinite amount of information in some sense there. And it's curious because although you have previously shared entanglement, you only send two classical bits of information, so one of four possible classical states to the other end. And it seems like you're able to communicate an infinite amount of information in teleportation, whereas that's not the case here. This model is entirely classical, and by sending four classical bits, you're only able to communicate at the ontic level. By sending two bits, you're only able to communicate two classical bits. So this doesn't have that paradox, and so definitely this is missing some feature of quantum theory, which is interesting. Maybe that's just interesting that one of the points of this model is that although it captures a lot of the qualitative features of quantum theory, it doesn't capture some of the features, and that's what's interesting about it. So
what happens if you allow not only uniform distributions? So if you allow, for example, that state that you want to teleport to be a non-equal probability distribution between box one and two, then do you teleport, so to speak, the same problem of the distribution over to
it? I think that's true. So this aspect of it would go through. If you allowed any distribution, then it would become less mysterious. So certainly you'd violate this knowledge balance principle. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't have a no cloning theorem. And teleportation is kind of mysterious in the context of a no cloning theorem.
Sure.
You know, I can't clone this, but I can teleport it. So it would be, you know, so one way of communicating information would just be to make a measurement onto the ontic state. and send that information. So it's sort of not mysterious in the same way.
If you allow non-uniform distributions, it also gets quite a lot harder to implement unitaries as permutations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's true. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you'd just
you'd
be well outside the sort of the model. So I think so. Rob's idea is that there's so the point of this model for Rob Speckens is that it illustrates that this idea of interpreting the quantum state epistemically. So if you think in terms of ignorance, although he doesn't actually get quantum theory, an epistemic interpretation where you have ignorance with some constrained ignorance, so you have here you have this balance principle, is able to get a lot of the features of quantum theory. So this is taken to be evidence that the epistemic approach is a good approach to investigate. Of course, for the things that actually work, you need to find a good epistemic model. And so far, none of the models that are out there are really very compelling. They're just ad hoc. Yeah. Did you have a question that was?
Yeah, I was wondering, is that the fact that you can only send finite information here connected to the fact that you've only got a finite number of states?
Although if you allow arbitrary distributions, you can still you'd have an infinite number of states, but they wouldn't be pure states, so to speak. But you can still only send a finite amount of information. There's something strange about the fact that this is these are all pure states and not convex mixtures. So it's having a finite number of pure states, perhaps, is the point. Yeah.
What are some obvious features that it doesn't
do? Okay, so that's going to be second part of this. So basically, the thing it doesn't reproduce, a box here, but is quantum contextuality. And so Bell's theorem can be thought of, so non-locality Bell's theorem can be thought of as an example of this. But let me just list it separately. It also doesn't reproduce that you have an infinite number of pure states for a finite level system. So there's a long list of things. Let's even write that down, because that's... So let me move on to this subject of quantum contextuality. So what I want to do is cover the old approach due to Koch and Specker. Which is in 1967, I think. And then the new approach due to, well, you've guessed it, Speckens, yeah. So first the old approach, or standard approach. Let's call it standard. It sounds much nicer. Okay. I want to give a definition of non-contextuality. So the idea is that you can associate values with things you might measure, with observables. So in each A. So imagine we have some measurement A corresponding to a mission operator A. And at any given time, we want to think that there is actually a value, the system actually has a value corresponding to this observable. And that value should be taken from the set of eigenvalues. And this is the value that would be revealed if you actually measure A. Okay. So we think there's some pre-existing value. And then it's just when you make a measurement, you just look, you just uncover the pre-existing value. So this is motivated by a very classical point of view. You know, in classical physics, if you have momentum and position and so on, if you make a measurement of momentum, you're just revealing the pre-existing value of the momentum of the particle and so on. It's the fact that you have this property in classical physics that people don't make a big fuss about having a theory of measurement. The values of the quantities are just the values you would get if you made a measurement. at least an ideal measurement. So one thing that this implies in particular is the following. These values are independent of whatever else you might be measuring at the same time. So they're independent of other commuting observables we might measure at the same time. So you could think of the value of A, given that we also measure B, which commutes with A, being equal to the value of A, given that instead we also measure C. So these are just written as, because it doesn't matter what else we measure, we can just write it like we did in the definition. B's, but you can write them as R's if you prefer. These are V's. I thought you said this.
Those are V's.
V for value. It's worth commenting here that here we're working in the picture, we're just working with observables sort of treated as Hermitian operators. We're not taking into account positive operator valued measures, which I imagine you did in Joe Emerson's course. I think people didn't really become aware of positive operator valued measures until much later. And I think there are many quarters in the theoretical physics community where people still don't really know about positive operator valued measures. So anyway, we're just working at this point in terms of the standard or old approach with Hermitian operators. Okay. Any questions about the definition?
So when you say that this is the reason there's no measurement problem for classical physics?
Yeah. I didn't quite say that. What I said is this is the reason people don't talk about the measurement process in classical physics.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what this means then is that the dynamics commute with measurement. And so if we had some sort of, we could have that, but also have some metaphysics, which is not.
Yeah, so the dynamics commute with sort of ideal measurements. So you can imagine in the classical case, you can always probe your system with sufficiently small particles that they don't really perturb the system in any way. They're just revealing where the system is. Whereas in the quantum case, we know that doesn't work. But it's still worth investigating this question just to see if that classical picture can be taken over to the quantum case.
I think I'm asking a slightly different question. So you could have a situation where you did measurements and you could always predict what result a measurement would give if you had a certain underlying an ontic state, I guess.
Right.
But where the set of ontic states is a distinct thing from the set of possible outcomes.
Right. Okay.
Is there any reason that would be a less tenable viewpoint to hold than the equivalent one for quantum mechanics, other than just it seems to matter less for actually predicting anything?
So in the case of quantum theory. I think the distinction you're drawing is that this underlying ontic variables may not have any sort of picture or values associated with them, but it's just that functions of those tell you what the outcomes are going to be in a deterministic fashion. In the case of classical theory, there's a very natural ontology provided. Just, you know, if you have a bunch of particles with positions, then the natural ontology is to say, well, those are the positions. Now, you could say, no, I'm just going to treat those as, I'm going to take that picture out and just imagine there's a bunch of hidden variable states, ontic states, and then define functions on those for measurements and get the usual classical picture. People don't do that because they don't need to. Whereas in the quantum case, it may be more motivated. I'm still not sure if I've answered your question.
I guess earlier we've drawn this distinction between between trying to determine whether these models we have for quantum mechanics could actually be what is in fact true.
Right. Okay.
As opposed to what?
Like you mean the local Biable issue,
yeah.
For example. Right. So I'm not sure how to answer. So suddenly the new approach due to Rob Speckens, so it takes more the point of view that you've just got ontic states and doesn't try to put a picture on them.
Okay.
You just have functions, and in fact, it even allows the response to be probabilistic. So a certain ontic state will probabilistically give a certain outcome. Mm-hmm. That's not the approach taken here. There's this sort of mental picture, I think, of pre-assigned values. In any case, for the mathematics of the theorem I'm about to tell you, you can probably take either point of view.
Okay.
The key thing is that you have a value for each one. That's a definite deterministic outcome. That's the best I can do. So let me... get to the theorem. So one type of observable we can consider is a projection operator. So, for example, have this observable, and it has eigenvalues at 1 and 0. And then we notice we have this commutation property. If we have two orthogonal states, the projection operators, two distinct orthogonal states, the projection operators commute. Okay, sorry, two orthogonal states. Orthogonal states are necessarily distinct. Over here, I should say, what this means is that the value has to be equal to 1 or 0. So over here, we have these projection operators commute. That means that you can measure them at the same time. So in particular, if we have an orthonormal set, then each of these will commute. And so we know that the values have to sum to 1. I should say a few more words about this. So we know that the value for each of these has to be equal to 0 or 1. But we also know that these are the values that are revealed when you make a measurement. And when you make a measurement, it's only possible to find one of these being equal to 1, or the others have to be equal to 0. If you perform a projection measurement, you find the state in one of the set of states you project onto. So this has to be true. So what we can do is we can find orthogonal sets of states, so we can find sets of orthogonal sets of states that share some vectors in common. bases. So, to draw a picture, this could be one basis set. And then we could have another basis set, which has also one, but has now rotated vectors. Two prime and three prime. Okay, so these two things share the same one vector but have different vectors here. So when we assign values, we're going to have to give the same value for the one as we did in both of these two cases. So you can see here what it means for it to be independent of context. We also know that when we assign this, we can only give one of the three vectors, in this case, the value 1, and then the other two vectors have to take the value 0 because they have to sum to 1. So it's possible to find sets of vectors that can't have values consistently assigned to them. So you can't assign values so that in each orthogonal set, only one has the value 1, and then the other have the value 0. So Koch and Spekka effectively did this. I mean, their example, I think, involved slightly different observables. Rather than projectors, they used spins, but it was equivalent to this. And they had 117 vectors, each living in a three-dimensional space, three-dimensional Hilbert space. So I'm not going to give you that. I'm also not going to give you the simpler one, but there's a much simpler one due to Adam Cabello. Which has 18 vectors. And so here's I'll just write down the first few equations to get the idea. So he represents his vectors. These are vectors for a four-dimensional Hilbert space. And it so happens that all the vectors have real coefficients. And he represents these vectors just by giving the coefficients in some basis here. And in the case where the coefficients wouldn't be nice if he normalizes them, he just writes them like this. So you should really normalize this vector by dividing by square root of 2 in that case. Okay, so he has 9 equations like this, consisting, and what happens is that each vector appears in 2 such equations. So here the vector 0, 0, 1 appears both here and here. And if you look through all the 9 expressions, you have each vector appearing twice.
And why do we have minus 1?
Sorry?
Why do we have?
Here. So this is just the coefficient in if you write this down as a Hilbert space vector, then it's and that's it, because there's no zero terms. And then you should normalize if you want, but so these are just the coefficients in the Hilbert space representation. Okay, so if you look at this, you can see there's a contradiction, because if you add all these expressions together, well, there's 9. So on the, let me go back to this. If you add the right-hand sides together, you get 9, which is odd. But the sum of the left-hand sides has to be even, because every value appears twice. And this is the contradiction. And it implies that quantum theory is contextual. You can't apply this naive way of thinking from classical physics. I'll go through Rob's approach tomorrow, then I'll move on to a new subject. Okay.
So there will be the lecture today by.
Right? Oh, yeah. So by Matthew Buzzi, and that's at what time? 4:00. Has he been reminded of that?
Yeah.
You just went, oh, great. Good. Okay, good. I was going to send him an email.